Good to be here for this meeting, and we want to continue what we started this morning in our study. During the class period, we talked about the love of Jesus. Appreciate the psalm selection that goes well with what we're studying. And this morning in the class period, as we talked about the love of Jesus, we talked about it from the aspect that, first of all, he demonstrated that great love, his Father did, in sending Jesus here. But then he also showed it in the fact that he served. We talked about John 13, and that he loved the disciples to the end. I mean, he went to the cross for them and for us. And so there is a lot in example. I mean, sometimes we have a hard time catching on. But when we see it in action in other people, then sometimes we connect and we can go forward with it. And in John 13, as he's trying to get his disciples to figure out what being a servant instead of a Lord is, he washed their feet. He showed them love. He demonstrated the kind of love as they saw it that they could emulate, they could mimic, and to be more like that. And we mentioned this morning that they would never forget that foot washing as he pierced their hearts with, he was a Lord, and you call me teacher, and that's right, when I came as a servant. And so after resurrection, we certainly see the change in their lives and how they serve the Lord. We also talked in that hour then about the human element, that Jesus had his inner circle. It talks in John 11th chapter how he loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus. He had a love for them. And yet we saw that he rebuked, if you would, or admonished Martha. Martha, Martha, you're concerned about all this stuff. But really there's one thing important. And Mary has chosen that good part. That did not drive them away, because later when Lazarus dies, who do they want to see? They wanted Jesus. And so as we looked at that, we saw that avenue, the human part of it. And sometimes we have chemistry as people. You meet folks and things just click. I mean, it's sort of natural. But not everybody's that way. And I quoted a friend of mine that said, some people are like human chiggers, man. They just get under your skin. But you have to work through that. We need to love them. And we see that in Jesus. We see his patience with his disciples. That they were slow learners, we talked about this morning in many ways. But the thing that brought them through is their character, the heart that they had. They loved the Lord. And we just, in passing, mentioned John 6, where we see that. The other disciples left. And you're going to leave also? Where should we go, Lord? For you have the words of life. It's the Spirit that gives life, he says. And then the third thing we talked about during that class in brief was Jesus' compassion. And that, you know, like 8 out of the 11 or 12 times that compassion's used in the Gospels is talking about Jesus. We saw that he raised the widow of Nain's son. He had compassion. He saw that woman's pain and her grief. Now, we pointed out the purpose of the miracles was to confirm the spoken word. And although Jesus' mission was spiritual, yet he had great compassion. And I need to be more like him. I mean, that's the bottom line in everything that we study about Jesus. I need to be more like him. He saw a number of folks that were sick. He came off the sea onto the land and he saw a multitude that were sick and he healed them. It says he had compassion. He could do that. And how many of us, we noted this morning, have gone to the hospital or we've seen someone, visit with someone who was sick or dying, and we'd like to be able to say, rise. But we just don't have that power. But we can still show the compassion to them in the capacity and the power that we have to help and support. Maybe it's just pray. And a lot of times we want to do something more than we can, and they know it, but they know, well, we're there, we can pray for them. God is powerful. But that they connect and they understand we really care, that we feel the compassion that Jesus demonstrated. And then we talked about the feeding of the 4,000. He had those disciples with him for 3 days, and they were hungry and sort of fainting along there, and it says he had compassion. And so we looked at those avenues then of the life of Jesus in the first hour during the study period this morning. What we did next then is we moved to Romans chapter 12, which I was originally going to do all three lessons, but since I had classes downstairs, I moved to that lesson. And we're talking then about some lessons found in Romans chapter 12. It was a single sermon that I was asked to do a year or so ago. But it again sort of segues from looking at the love of Jesus into our relationship as disciples. And so this morning we looked at point 1 and 2, let love be without hypocrisy, and to be devoted to one another in brotherly love. And we'll buzz through these slides real quick. and then we'll finish up the other parts of that slide. We know that this morning, the first 11 chapters of Romans tell us about the wonderful things that God has done. We were lost in sin, and we have redemption in Christ, which we'll talk about tomorrow night in our study. But in looking at that, we see chapter 12 says, has that great big word, and then I ask 20, what's that big word, therefore? You see, therefore, wherefore, you ask yourself what it's there for. I circle that in my Bible. It's a flag, and I need to make sure I know what's going on here. And so chapter 12 is basically picking up and saying, God has done all this in these first 11 chapters. Now, how does that play out in my life? And as we said, we could hold 20 or 30 gospel meetings from chapter 12 alone. I mean, there's just a host of things. It's sort of like a shotgun blast. You know, it's just here, 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 here. But you know what I find interesting about that, sort of getting on a sidetrack here, is Paul expected people to figure that out. They didn't have to have a commentary about that. So you get people to do this and that, and sometime to come back and get this again. But it's understandable and applicable. And so we're just looking at a couple of those things today. But as we go along, we notice because of what all God has done for us, it transforms our life in chapter 12. And that plays out. It is this motivation, it is the gratitude that we have for what God has done for us that drives us to respond not only to Him, but consequently to His children, our brothers and sisters. And that drives all five of these points that we're looking at in this particular study. These things are linked together. If I don't have a love for God and gratitude and compassion that comes from a God-fearing, God-centered, God-appreciative life, then these other things, as I try to act them out of my life, are going to fail to have a force. And the genuineness, I mean, the people can oftentimes read. And so hopefully, as we look at this, we'll be able to see that further. We talked about love, let love be without hypocrisy. We saw that carries with it the idea of genuineness. That love should not be something that's pretentious. We're not pretending. And of course, at the bottom, we've got this definition of a hypocrite we mentioned this morning. To play actor, you know, I'm acting this way. Here's how I'm acting like I feel, but really inside, you know, get out of here, you know. I don't have that. And so there's a genuineness that comes through. And I tell you what, that genuineness radiates from a genuineness inside. It radiates on the outside as well. Now, I realize people can pretend. And they can put on a good face. And it looks like here's what they are on the outside, where inside, that's not what they are at all. And that's a problem that Jesus is addressing much of the Gospels with the Jewish leaders, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, as they would make reference to the law of Moses, the beginning of Matthew chapter 23, Jesus tells the disciples, you listen. When they teach the law of Moses, they say this is what the book says. You listen to it and you do it. But they won't lift a finger to try to do it themselves. On the outside, here's how they're pretending, but on the inside, just dead men's bones. And so much could be said about that. But what we're driving at here in Paul is this genuineness in our love for each other. And we're talking about the agape love in this particular word. And as we looked at that this morning, we saw a little bit about how, you know, that plays out in our day-to-day life, how that hammers out, and looked at a couple of examples in that regard. And as Christians, we became obedient to the truth and purified our souls for a sincere love of brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. This idea fervently carries with it sort of a boiling up. You know, we want to love each other. We want to do good for each other. And we try to draw that distinction between the agape love and this next word that we'll look at, the idea of this friend, this family friend warmth association. And we noted this morning that although the agape love is a little more of an intellectual thing, this is what I need to do, that it carries much emotion with it as well. It's not dead. It's not on the shelf like it's just a piece of machinery. It is driven out of care and compassion. The love that God had for us in John 3:16 was driven by genuine care. It wasn't emotionless, but it was driven by what was right and good and what we needed. Now, that overlaps as we talk about the next word in a moment, the idea of brotherly kindness. But when we get there, we'll again hopefully mention that. I gave you an illustration that I liked. I don't remember where I read it. It was by Jim McGuigan. As I mentioned, he's an institutional guy. Then he's got some things to say that aren't on target sometimes, but he's got some great other things to say. And he told a story about some soldiers in Scotland. And they'd been out in the mountains, and it'd been raining, and they were muddy and tired, and they came in, and this fellow that was a Christian, as McGuigan reports it, the private, you know, he bows down to his bunk there, and he starts to offer prayer. And about that time, the sergeant picks up his muddy boot and throws it over at him, hits him upside the head. He can't stand these Christian people. And so the next morning, the sergeant got up, and his boots were all cleaned up and shined and set nearby his bed. That private had done that afterwards. So that's not the spirit that you would have seen in me, which means that I didn't have the spirit of Christ like that man did. And as McGuigan unfolds that story, what happened is eventually the sergeant says, man, if that's what a Christian is about, I've got to find out about this. And eventually, according to what he wrote, that this man then also saw Jesus. Now that's the kind of love, the agape love. It's not because I feel like it, because I thank you for hitting me upside the head with that boot. Man, that hurt. It's throbbing for 3 days. But it's the way that we react for this man's good and to the glory of God, not myself. And so that helps me. It shames me that I have not done better in certain circumstances in the course of my life. And it compels me, hopefully, to remember that when I get into tight and it's straight in a situation where I may want to respond according to the flesh rather than according to the spirit. And so as we look at love, we see, you know, that is an example of it playing out. Listen, I could see that. See, if I was one of these other soldiers or that sergeant, that's an example of I can see. There's no argument around that. A lot of other things we rationalize away, but I tell you, when you see that magnitude of love carried out, and it's not because the sergeant deserved it, but it leaves an impact, and it did on that. Well, secondly, then the next terms that we look at is being devoted to one another in brotherly love. And one of the things that we noticed in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and in verse 9, which is useful to me a little bit, is it gives us some indication about the matter of love that we're talking about in the agape love. And the word that we're talking about here, this brotherly love, being devoted, down to a definition, you're feeling or showing devotion. Ardent, zealous. See, we talk about somebody being devout Catholic, where they're committed to Catholicism. This is telling us that we need to be devoted to each other, brothers and sisters. And we're devoted to one another, that's mutually, one another, in brotherly love. That's the word we get Philadelphia from, the city of brotherly love. Okay? And so this is a family affection. And I've got it in here, always the family affection, and I use an illustration in the winter of a wood stove. You fire a wood stove up and you're cold and everybody comes up. It draws you. This kind of genuine warm care for each other has a drawing power to it. And it affects our congregations and our community. And it's critical that we have it. And certainly, we have admonition by the Lord that we do this. Now, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 9, we noted that it says, now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. It's interesting that both of these terms, the agape term is here, and this Philadelphia term is here, and it says, the first part of there, concerning this Philadelphia, this love for the brethren, this warmth, this family love for the brethren, you don't have anyone, there's no need to write to you about that. Why? Because you have already been taught by God to agape one another. Now what that tells me about the relationship of agape and this Philadelphia love, this family love, is the kind of love, the agape love, is going to promote this. They go hand in hand. And as we serve and sacrifice someone else, we draw near and we tend to love them more and more as we invest ourselves into them in this agape love and trying to do good for them. And that sort of rubs off overflows, if you would, into our feelings and emotions. You may remember Matthew 5 where Jesus said, pray for your enemies. You know, it's hard to hate those you're praying for. I've had people that haven't been very happy with me in the course of my life. And a couple of occasions, especially when I was praying for them for several reasons. But one of the things that comes out of that is it's hard for me to have that bitter spirit or the kind of spirit I shouldn't have if I'm earnestly praying.
Amen.
And that's what Jesus said to do for our enemies. Now, much more as we see this relationship about being devoted to one another in brotherly love, those are precious bonds. And again, I don't have time to go back through all that we did. But we did mention a couple more things in the next charts of yours. And since a number of you weren't here this morning, I'm taking more time to go through these first charts than I would. But, you know, there's something that you cannot keep me from doing, brother or sister. You cannot keep me from loving you. You don't have the power to do that. Now, you may treat me really bad, but you cannot keep me from loving you. My cousin sent me this picture back 2 or 3 years ago. And a certain homeowners association said, you cannot fly a flag, an American flag, in your yard. And so this was his response. Some brother may say, you can't love me. Yes, you can. You may not be able to do what you want to do, may not do this or that, but we must continue to love, and that message must come across. It's easy for us to find fault with our brethren or other people, our neighbors, and depending on how we grew up and how we were raised in our mindset, you know, it's hard to discount other people because of their shortcomings, their faults. And we need to have long suffering because people have shortcomings. And people have to be long-suffering with me because I have my shortcomings. But I love this secular statement by Theodore Roosevelt. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds? Who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails at least, while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. That's just a secular statement about when you make efforts, you know, if you're going to swing at the ball, you're going to have a strike once in a while. That's life. And so as we think about brotherly love, let's be engaged and do what we can, brethren. Let's do all that we can to help the church. This local congregation, I mean, that's sort of where this plays out. It plays out in my life, in your life, and the work that's going on here. It takes patience. And it takes love of brethren. You know, what happens is we spend a lifetime, you know, sort of developing attitudes and failures, and we get in ruts and so forth. But it's like I used an illustration of a lady who was in depression years ago. I said, you know, it's like going to the Grand Canyon. And you walk down this trail. I've never been there. But you walk down this trail, and you get down here at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. You look down there and say, I don't want to be down here. I want to be up there. Well, it took you a while to get down here. It's going to take you a while to get back up. And so is it with the patterns and the habits that we set in place in life oftentimes. I realize repentance can change things dramatically in the blood of Christ. And so we're not taking that into consideration. But as we think about trying to turn the hearts and souls of people around and for their growth, we see oftentimes it takes significant time. So let's do what we can do. Now the third thing then in our study that we want to do for the next little bit is we want to talk about giving preference to one another in love. And as we think about that, let's see, I've got some notes in here somewhere. They're there. That's helpful. As we think about giving preference to one another in honor, that comes hand in hand with what we've just been talking about, agape, and about this family love, this phileo kind of loving that we have. But when we talk about that we give preference, we prefer one another in honor, again, you notice this one another term, this reciprocal pronoun that comes. That means I love you and you love me. Or here, that I honor you and you honor me. We give preference to one another in honor. Honor just carries with it an idea of a high respect or esteem. You know, as men, that's one of the things that we especially value. We want to be respected. That's one of the fundamental parts of our makeup and being. We want to be honored, and men tend to recognize that to some degree. I mean, women need that also. 1 Peter 3:7 shows that husbands are to honor their wives, and so we're not discounting that. But as we look at this matter of respect, it means a lot. And it means a lot in our relationships as well. And that as we look at this, notice point C, outdoing one another in showing honor. It's a literal kind of a statement here of how this. And the idea is I am trying to show you more honor than you're showing me. And that's not in a bad sense, but it's showing that I'm holding you above me. Now, what is the trick for that to happen? If I don't feel that way, I've got to start working towards that change in my mind and my thinking. But the way that I can really do that best is if that's how I think about you. I mean, that's really what we're looking at. When in my heart and my perception of you, I show respect. I really honor you in my heart more than I do me. Then that's not hard. That's the problem when I'm trying to hold you up above me when I don't feel that way. That's just good old base pride. I mean, that's one of the greatest tools in the devil's workbox. Paul Earnhardt did a lesson on demonic duo years ago about pride and envy. It said of the tools, the lust of the eye and the lust of the flesh, that pride might be at the top of those. And I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. But what we see in this is as we talk about giving preference to one another in honor, that we're to outdo one another in showing honor. Philippians 2:3, doing nothing through selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourself. That doesn't mean that you aren't mindful of your needs or your feelings, but what it carries with it is you're not absorbed in yourself. And you are thinking about others. You're trying to hold them up. Again, now how do you do that? Well, you have to have respect in your heart for them. There's another story about a fellow that's referred to as a commentary that William Barclay did about, he called him Principal Carnes. He was an academic in England. But there was this big gathering, and some fellows were coming up across the stage, I think probably to receive some recognition. And this fellow he refers to as Principal Carnes, he comes up, and as he gets up there, everybody starts clapping. And this man looks around at the guy behind him. He's clapping him. He's not even thinking about himself. So they must be talking about this guy behind me. And he was the one being honored by all these people. But the reason he's being honored, because he wasn't even thinking about himself. That was the spirit that he had. And on this occasion, as he reveals this situation, he said, well, he must be talking about him. Well, he's a great guy back there. And so it's a great illustration of character and attitude. There's a selflessness there. And the truth of the matter is, I believe that when I learn to be more selfless, I'll find myself being a lot happier. I'll find myself being a lot more productive. I'll find myself being more fruitful. I'll find myself in a place to be able to encourage, to exhort, and to help. But it's so hard for me to get me out of the middle of things. And so as Paul writes here, talks about that we give this preference to one another, we show this kind of respect to each other, it is great and a blessing to us. But our human pride and self-centeredness can get in the way. And I've written in my notes down here, a happy home will not be a selfish home. That's so as we talk about parents. And later in the week, I'll be talking something about families. And that's one of the things about the family relationship. Selfishness kills it and kills that relationship. But what we find is in a home where we serve and we are to be the head of our homes, as fathers, we are to serve our homes. We go back to John 13 and look at Jesus, who was the Lord and the teacher. Yeah, he was the head, yet he came to serve. And so is it in my home. That although I'm the head of my home, my purpose is to serve my Lord, certainly, but my family. That I'm to lead and to guide and to care for their needs the best that I can. And as a provider and a protector and all those things, I'm looking after their interests. But again, this kind of honor is powerful and is useful in the course of our lives and in the course of our relationships. And I tell you, that just to be real frank about it, through the years, many times it's killed the church because it's been self-respecting rather than honoring one another. And I know that's difficult. And as I said, some people are human chiggers. They're hard to deal with. But the truth of the matter is, if I could stand aside and see how hard I am to deal with, I might be more compassionate when I realize what all people have done to put up with me through the years. We're all in this together, brethren. We're all under condemnation of sin. Your people, by the mercy of God, have been forgiven. And that's the boat I'm in and that you're in. And as we said at the beginning of the study here, when I understand that, then I'm in a position to be grateful and a better position to serve and a better position to love and to have brotherly love and honor. And also, out of the great appreciation for what God has done for me, that brings us then to our next point that we want to look at here in contributing to the needs of the saints. There are various needs that arise, and Paul talks about that here as he writes to these brethren, contributing or participating, acting as their partners in their needs. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 18 tells about those that are rich in this present world. Instruct those to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous, ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. 1 Timothy 6:18 and 19. I won't give you any indications where this is at, but I was blessed to be in a meeting last spring, and the man that I stayed with probably had more money than anybody I've ever been around. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but he probably lost as much in the downturn in the previous 3 or 4 years. He probably lost more than I'll make in 10 of my lifetimes. I mean, but he was a good man. But what he had done, he'd focused on that when he was younger, but he'd turned that around. And he was trying to do a lot of good with that. Now, I was not the direct recipient of that, so I don't misunderstand. You know, he didn't leave me $1 million or something. But he treated me as a friend and courteous. I had a great time with him. And I was encouraging him to do some things. And after I left, he had a massive heart attack and died. And just totally unexpected. But I've just thought about that a lot of times. You know, I don't know how much he was worth. But I know that he was so generous with what he had. And he helped men in evangelism and preaching in different places. Most of the things I'm not even supposed to know about, of course. I got them indirectly. He didn't tell me that. He didn't tell me any of that. Because that's not what he's concerned about. He was trying to help. He was trying to use what he could. The church where he was at, again, he didn't tell me this, but somebody else did that I was close to. And they said, you know, things get in a bind here. You know, he puts a big chunk of change in there. It wasn't to show off. It was to meet the need. And so, you know, I sometimes think about folks that have a lot of money. It's easy to get in my ear thinking, well, you know. But he may have dealt better with his money than I dealt with mine. And so I have to be careful about the spirit that I have. But no matter where we're at, if we have very little, or if we have, like this man, had a great deal of money, we need to use what we can to the good and to the glory of God's kingdom and to the glory of God. And as we see at what Paul encourages them to do here, he says those that are rich in 1 Timothy chapter 6, you know, you use those things, understanding that is not your redemption. You don't believe your government can't take your money away, just keep watching. If you think you got IRAs and they're guaranteed by the government, well, who's going to guarantee the government? But I know him in whose hands are all things. And whatever we have been entrusted with, we need to use to his glory. So, brethren, I'm preaching to me. I hope you're getting some of this. Seriously. This is for me as much as it is to anybody. All these lessons. And you remember 2 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, chapters 8 and 9 deal with the giving. And as you read about that, this morning was mentioned concerning the contribution that, you know, we're to give cheerfully, bountifully, and so forth from chapter 9. But back in chapter 8, as Paul is trying to admonish the brethren that they had made a commitment already, you know, previously to meet this need back in Jerusalem to the poor saints, we find that they were doing that. But what he does is he uses the zeal between the brethren of Macedonia and Achaia. Chapter 9, verse 2 basically says zeal stirs up zeal. Their zeal stirs up your zeal. But in chapter 8 and that we're looking at here in verse 5, let me read verse 4. Begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation, that's the word for fellowship, and the support of the saints, and this, not as we had expected, But they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Now, they were poor. Matter of fact, as you read this, they were poor to the place they may have almost needed help. But they wanted to help. They wanted to participate. And so they plead, let us help more. And they did. They went above and beyond their means, basically, is what we see. And as they do this, God was glorified, as we keep studying chapter 8 and chapter 9, as they rose to meet those needs. So here's a contribution for the poor saints. Now, I'm going to take a sidestep here for just a minute, and this may not amount to much to most of you. There's always a plea overseas, and the overseas work for money. And I'm grateful my American brethren are generous. But there's a lot of times American money has hurt the work more than it has helped the work.
Amen.
And I tell you, that's the hardest thing over there that I've ever dealt with through the years. You want to have compassion, and you want to be generous, and you want to give. But if you're not careful, you ruin the work, because you get people drawn for money for the wrong purpose. Now, I don't have the answer to that. And we struggle with that. We struggle with that in working Sierra Leone, to how to balance that. Last time we met together talking about, well, maybe here's what we need to do. We just need to close this spigot because it's causing problems, and we need to let these brethren take care of that stuff. And so I throw that in there as an adjunct to this lesson. But we want to meet the needs of the brethren. And Andy may have told you, Rick, already, but they found out a couple years ago when I was there, they have a communication system. They may say 001. That means I had nothing to eat for breakfast. I had nothing to eat for lunch. I had something to eat at supper tonight. Or 100. I had something first thing this morning. And so we don't talk that way, do we? We don't say, where am I going to get something to eat? It's, you know, we got this many places we can go eat. Where would you like to go eat? And I'm thankful for that. But as we look at trying to meet the needs of the saints, we have folks locally that we're associated with sometimes that are down and out. They have needs, people that are willing to work. I mean, they've had some bad luck. Maybe they made some bad decisions, you know, but we still want to show mercy. If the Lord never showed me any mercy because I made bad decisions, then I would never have any mercy. But there is a difference between our needs and our wants. My dad tried to impress that on me when I was growing up. You know, I want this, and I want that. He said, you know, food and shelter, you know, that's your needs. You need something to eat, a place to keep this body protected. Those are your needs. The rest of the stuff, a telephone, a faster car, those are wants. And as we think of life, we need to remember that, because we have lived in such prosperity, although we think our economy's taken a downturn in many areas it has, it is hard for us to understand this distinction between needs and wants. But in some 27 times, this word need or needing and so forth is used in the New Testament. And as Christians, we need to contribute. We make the effort to give to help the needs of the saints. And in the New Testament, as you read, there were problems that way. There were folks who actually had needs. And we can go to the book of 1 John chapter 3 and verses 16 through 22. 1 John 3, 16 through 22. And there it talks about, see your brother in need. He says in verse 17, but whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. Now, we're to respond to those needs in deed, that means we do it, and truth, and in goodwill. But if we close our heart of compassion, you know, where are we? And of course, we could go back to James chapter 2 and talk about faith. Faith without works. It talks about a similar thing there. But we see this need. If we see our brother in need and we close our heart, we don't have any compassion for him. Although it's not up here, that makes me think of Matthew chapter 25. You remember there's three stories there. The first one is about the 10 virgins, then the talents, the 5, 2, and the 1 talent. And then there's the great judgment scene and the separation of the sheep from the goats. And in the midst of that, what he says is, you come on in here, my children. He says, you know, I was hungry and sick, and what did you do? You fed me, and you visited me, and so forth. You came and looked after me. So, well, when did we do that? You notice the selflessness in that statement. When did we do that to you, Lord? He said, when you did it to one of these least of my brothers, you did it unto me. And there was a meeting of needs. And you see there that comes in different ways. It may not only be that I can't pay utility bills to stay warm in the midst of a snowstorm this winter. Maybe I'm sick. Maybe I'm in prison for it. May be one of these days for preaching that homosexuality is wrong. But whatever it is, you remember when you serve your brother, you're not just serving your brother. That passage shows we're doing that. We're serving the Lord as we rise to meet those needs, contributing to the needs of the saints. And by the way, one of the things that helps that way is we've got to have our eyes open. We've got to be looking, and we've got to try to be attuned. I tell you, that's along with about 4 zillion other ways that ladies have helped me through the years. Sometimes they're so much more attuned to that than I am. And my wife will nudge me and say, did you call so-and-so? Or, what about this? And thank you, ladies. But we're in this together, looking out for each other's good and doing what we can to meet their needs. Sometimes that visiting the orphans and the widows that James 1:27 talks about is to meeting physical needs. And at times it's just they need some companionship. They're sitting in solitary confinement. They can't get out. They can't do anything. And I tell you, 2-foot walls look about 20 feet tall when you sit in day after day, week after week. And so there are many ways that we can arise to meet the needs of our brethren. We can pray about it. Lord, help me see them. We can make a list of things to help us remember. A to-do list. I need to get this done. But we are blessed and of our love for God and our brotherly love. We see this kind of honor and then this caring for the saints. And then hand in hand with that, my last chart is the fifth point we have here, practicing hospitality. This term that's used here carries with it the idea of a regular doing or an improving with doing. That our ability to do hospitality, it gets to be easier the more we do it. We get more comfortable with it. And I love going in maybe to a young couple's home. Maybe it's for a meeting, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just in a congregation. And this is the first time they've invited somebody into their home to try to show hospitality. What a joyous occasion. As they're trying to learn that and do that. And hopefully we'll grow in that. And notice in a book that I've got, it's a little bit of a technical book, not the mere exercise, but the active search for opportunity is implied in the statement that's made. And so as you look at that, we're looking to be hospitable. Now, you notice below that the word hospitality itself means a lover of strangers. And as you look at your New Testament, it's a fundamental Christian duty that we are hospitable. The lover of strangers carries with it maybe somebody that we're not as familiar with. We bring them in. You could go back. There's a passage in Hebrews chapter 13 that you have seen here on the bottom. And Abraham entertained those three strangers. One of them seems to be the Lord. I'm not sure that technically its language seems to carry that with it. But then two of those angels go into Sodom and Gomorrah afterwards. You remember that? But this passage seems to be referring to that. Let love of brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For by this some have entertained angels without knowing it, remembering the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves also are in the body. There's several things. You notice how this ties with what we're just talking about meeting the needs of the saints. This grows out of that. You notice also here, we see the word hospitality, and although it carries with it the idea of a lover of strangers up here. You notice here, show hospitality to strangers, but also, what have we been talking about? Let love of the brethren continue. That's that word Philadelphia. See how this stuff is all tied together? And it grows and extends one from the other. As we learn to agape, then we learn to better phileo, or warmly feel that family relationship. And it's easier for me to honor my brother or my sister. And it's easier, you're having this problem, I want to help you. And then here, to try to have the encouragement, exhortation of opening my home, both to strangers and to my brethren. William Tyndale talked about this practicing hospitality, described it this way, a harborous disposition. You remember when Paul was headed to Rome in the book of Acts? He was in ship, he was under arrest, they're taking him to Rome, and they come around. There is a port called Fair Haven. The idea behind that is just this beautiful, peaceful, secure port. That's what I think of when I think about this harborous disposition. There are homes that are like a refuge. And that's what we see in hospitality. We're out in this world that is just tearing itself apart and striving after the flesh, and we have this refuge in the Lord, certainly. But in our association, we come together with those of a like precious faith, and we can let down, we can breathe, we can be refreshed, we build bonds, we find out each other's struggles, we help each other, hopefully pray for each other, and we pull together until finally we get home. That's only 5 points out of Romans chapter 12. You see how we're all tied together. And how they help us as a body of Christ. How they help me as a Christian. And they help me as I try to serve my Lord and Savior. There are lots of folks that help me along this way. There are some people that have a spirit as though they had a welcome sign sort of on their forehead. You notice that? They're just warm and open. Just come on in like you're their long-lost friend. And they're sort of that way towards lots of people. I want to be more like that. Something I learned in India, when you're eating there, it's hard not to overeat. They make you a big plate of rice and curry and have it out there. And you say, man, that's a lot. You eat that, and it overeats. Oh, you need some more. You need some more. No. Oh, yes, you need some more. And so finally, they embarrass you to death. You eat a little bit more. Oh, then you get that done. You need some more. And Vijay Benson is the guy that I would stay with when I stayed in India. I asked him about that. And he said, back during the time where we had famines, there was not enough to go around. People were hungry. They would come into your home. And they would take it because they knew, man, this you may not have hardly anything. They would hold back to take any more. And out of that then grew this idea, I want to keep extending to you. And so we see, again, in hospitality, that our hearts and our homes need to be a welcome place for our brethren and for strangers, that God might be glorified and that we might help each other on our journey.